Hi everyone, and thank you for joining us on Lit Radio podcast. I'm Teja, and today I'll be speaking with Bob Sheard about his book, The Brand New Future: How Brands Can Save the World. Bob is the co-founder of Fresh Britain, which for the past 20 years has designed over 200 global brands. The Brand New Future is a call to action for brands and consumers to rethink how we think, design, produce, and consume. It's a call for collective and individual brilliance, an appeal to redesign our future. While we may not find solutions for sustainable living in our lifetime, our everyday choices can provide pathways for future generations. So, hi Bob, it's a great pleasure to have you with us on Lit Radio podcast. I'm very excited to talk with you about your book, The Brand New Future. How are you today?
Very good, thank you. Had a great weekend. I'm very excited to be on the podcast too, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Great. So my first question is, why did you decide to write the book?
I've spent 25 years designing brands, and I've designed over 250 brands, from Levi's to Louis Vuitton, from New Balance to Nike. And in that process, you kind of craft a skill about making brands cool, but you also, the artistry comes when you can make them cool and make them grow and make them profitable. And we've managed to achieve that over the years with brands like Salomon, Arc'teryx, Renault, Volvo. And it came to a sort of dawning realization that whereas I used to spend the early part of my career really making brands cool, getting great products into great retail outlets, so I'd be the happiest guy on the planet if I saw one of my sneakers in Colette or Corsa Coma or Luisa Villaroma. But I had this sort of dawning realization that actually what I'm really good at is making people buy stuff they don't really need, making brands make stuff that people don't really need, but they want them. So you end up being really good at creating landfill. And so it was the growing realization that I'd been doing that, and actually that's not the greatest contribution to the human condition. So I then set about figuring out how I could redeploy those skills to help people and help brands grow beyond zero, maybe helping them find pathways to growth that didn't involve the making of products, but the making of memories, experiences, knowledge, intelligence, and whatnot. And I did a conference on it last year. And on my panel, I had the ex-CEOs of LVMH. I had the sort of leader of the Formula One Foundation, the FIA. Had people from UNICEF, education, head of St. Martin. And we just brainstormed it. And at the other side of the conference, the feedback normally we get, that was interesting. Or this time we got people from Burberry coming up and saying this was a dream-fueling event, blown away. And so the feedback was amazing. And I think it was amazing because I think we're all sort of drifting into this consciousness that we've got to change, but without anybody designing the change that's necessary. And we started to touch on that change at the conference. And so kind of it was percolating in my brain about maybe we should get this down on paper, because what I've learned over the last 25 years is a way of designing brands that involves communication design, product design, branding design, graphic design, culture design, business design, storytelling, the classics. But there's no way you can learn all those things together in one faculty called brand design. And so I thought, actually, we need to get this down, and then we need to get this into some kind of educational platform that enables people to understand the levers they can pull in brand design to maximize value. It, really simply, the value of a goods company, 20% of it is the value of its brand. The value of a services company, it's up to 40%. When you consider a national economy, it's the sum of its goods and services. So by proxy, it's the sum of its brands. It would be really helpful if people on a governmental level, but also on a business level, understood brand design in such a way they can maximize value. And so I wanted to get it down, and it was just a matter of figuring out a way to do it. So that's why I did it.
Absolutely. And I believe it's a very important conversation to have, and also a book as well. But before we talk a little bit more about that, Could you tell me, because this is a book podcast, could you tell me what was the writing process like for you? How long did it take you to write the book? Well, how did you actually do it?
Well, a book, it took me about 3 months of getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and writing for sort of 5 hours before work. And the way I did it is that it's the way my brain sort of works. I don't know what happens in the evening, but it sort of seems to accumulate stuff through the night. And then I wake up in the morning and it kind of has to come out. It needs somewhere to go. So the way I did it was I had a basic structure. And then if something came to me into the night, it might not have come in the chronology of the structure, but it was just a thought. I'd just speak it into my phone. And then the phone would sort of annotate it. And then I would edit it. So it's a bit like I'd probably have had a drink the night before as well. So it's a bit like Hemingway used to say, sort of write drunk and edit sober. So I would kind of write after a good night's sleep or maybe a good night out, and it would all come out. And then I would edit later in the day, once I'd seen the thing annotated. But I was really helped because I started that process, and then sadly my godmother died, and I went to her funeral in Peterborough. And my mum, all my family are from Bradford. They're all market traders. And when I say market traders, I mean we sold hosiery and shirts, not stocks and shares. But we were all market traders. We came down to this funeral, and my mum booked us into the Peterborough North Premier Inn, 50 quid a night. And then when we went to the wake, I said to our kid, I said, "Look, this looks well dodgy in here." Anyway, within 3 hours, my family had been asked to leave, and they weren't going to serve us any more drinks and never to come back again. Which it kind of got slightly mental. And then the next day, I went to another party, and it was at that party that, which was in Rutland Water, where I realized it was next to the graveyard where a friend of mine's wife had been buried, and I'd helped him with the eulogy 3 years before. So I wrote to him and said, he lives in Singapore, so do you want me to leave some flowers in the grave? And he said, no, but her sister would like to meet you because she'd like to meet the guy that helped me with the eulogy, because I wrote a eulogy about a moonbow, which is like ephemeral and indelible, like a life cut short. Anyway, this woman came in and met me. And I didn't know her. She arrived, we had breakfast. I just told her the truth about the night previously where we'd all been barred from the Premier North for being mental. And I said, "But I'm really nervous about that later today because I'm off to a school reunion and I'm going to meet the girl I lost my virginity to 36 years ago. So I'm quite nervous about that situation." And she seemed quite intrigued by the conversation and said, "Look, let me know how the reunion went." Anyway, we then met a month later, so I could tell her how the reunion went, having had this kind of aeroplane conversation. And when we met, we exchanged emails, and on the bottom of her email, it said that she was the head of policy at Number 10 in the Cabinet Office. So I'd been talking to her about all sorts of stuff, thinking I'd never see her again in my life. And then we met for breakfast, and I said, "Look, I'm in the middle of this book, and I'm a sort of optimist idealist that can't really spell. I'm totally dyslexic. And I kind of need a pragmatist realist that can spell. And given that you're head of policy at the Cabinet Office of Number 10, I imagine you're pretty much a pragmatist. So do you fancy helping me with this book? Because I know you're into global prosperity and I'm trying to figure out global prosperity." Anyway, she went away for a couple of months doing sort of global stuff. And then we came back and she said, I'd sent her three chapters, and she came back and said, "Look, I think there's some genius in your book, but it reads like you're bipolar. There's a kind of active and a passive sense to it, and I can help flatten that out for you." So she then helped me as a writing companion, which was massive for me, and I would never have got this done without her. And I think she makes me sound a lot more intelligent than I am. And then the process was to hand it in to the publishers, and then the publisher came back and said, "We need more of your voice," which I took to mean more swearing, so I put a bit more swearing in the book, and then that's it. It's gone now. So that's been the process, but it helps to have someone to bounce it off with, and someone who, you can't see. I often say this to my clients: is we're like goldfish. We can't see our own water in a goldfish bowl. Other people can see it very easily, and it's the same with writing. They can see what you're trying to say, and you might not have said it. And that was really helpful.
Absolutely. And Bob, I have to say that's probably one of the most fascinating stories about writing a book I've heard on this podcast. But yeah, I think it worked quite well. But now, yeah, let's talk a little bit about the content of the book and your ideas. But before we discuss how brands should be working, can you talk to us a little bit about how brands work today?
Yeah, they work today. So basically, if you're as a consumer, we feel seven times quicker than we think. So it takes us seven times longer to think that we can afford the product than we are feeling that we want the product. And we've all felt that, whether you've been in a handbag store or a car show, and you're like, I want that. And then you've got to figure out how you can afford it. So when we're building a brand that operates, you have to build a story that operates in our subconscious. So it has to be, it sounds like an impossible thing. Like, how do you design a story that's in someone's subconscious? It's that easy because we've all been read bedtime stories. So we've all grown up watching films. And those films all have their roots in sort of narrative design that goes right the way back to Greek mythology and Roman mythology and stuff. So you just have to pick a story that's universal and timeless and exists there. So when you're designing a brand, you have to be acutely aware that all a brand is it's an expression of a meaning system. And when it works, it connects with a person's meaning system. And so when they're wearing a product or a logo, it's an expression of who they are. They're having a conversation with that logo with everybody they're not going to talk to that day. So we've got to design a story that exists in their memory, but it's a story that they want to see themselves in. So, for example, we did Bear Grylls. So Bear Grylls came to us and said, "Look, I need to figure out a way of scaling." And so what we did is we said, "Look, you used to be a mountaineer, so you used to be an adventurer. That's Odysseus stepping off the map. You're also in the SAS, so you're also a soldier. That's kind of Achilles. It's kind of Bond-like stuff." But you're getting into your mid-50s now, so we need to sort of, who's the role for you? And it's someone who's been there, got the scars, and come back, and is now empowering and enabling other people. So it's kind of a guide role. If you go back into Greek mythology, the guide archetype is a guy called Chiron, who was half horse, half man. Being half horse, he was a bit weird, but had all the intuition of an animal. Being half man, he was very intelligent. But the gods expelled him from the palace because he was half horse, half man. So, like in many other myths, he spent 40 years wandering around the wilderness, but became an amazing survivalist, learning to live in balance with nature, in tune with nature as an animal, but also being able to codify that as a human with his intellect. Then, when the gods went to war, they thought he's going to be quite handy. We'll bring him back in, put him on the battlefield. He overcame everybody. They then realized he was an amazing warrior. And therefore, their children should be schooled by him in the ways of nature, the ways of balance, and the ways of respecting your enemy and being in battle. So they sent Hercules to be taught by him and Achilles and all that. And as I'm telling you the story, it should be kind of resonating because actually, in modern day storytelling, that's Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars, it's Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. So people can resonate, and I can see that, I can feel that in my subconscious. And so then when we built the Bear Grylls brand, we built it to equip, to educate, and to empower, with him positioned as the guide. And that's what you do. And once you've built the sort of emotional side of it, you then have to structure it in such a way that you structure the positioning of the brand so it's really clear and compelling. And that will generate turnover. People understand who you are, they'll come to you. Then you build the personality of the brand so that it's addictive. So that you create a serial and episodic relationship with the consumer. You go through the core products and then onto non-core products. And then you build the purpose. So you've got a compelling purpose that drives the ambition of the brand. And that needs a moral purpose and a market purpose. With those three things brought together, means you've designed the levers of the brand to optimize turnover, profitability, and purpose. And that's how brands could grow today. And obviously, conventionally, you're gearing all of that to sell more stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you mentioned that a little bit earlier in the conversation about creating more stuff, and then a lot of that stuff, it ends up in landfills. So in the book, you're saying that brands, they should actually be the new democracy, and they should be having a very important role in tackling the climate change. But considering that we have our governments, why do you think it's up to brands to save the world?
Well, it's not just up to brands. It's up to everybody. But brands have their role to play. And as brand designers, we have our role to play. So if you look at the three things that adversely affect the quality of our lives over the last 10 years, it's been COVID, it's been conflict, and it's been climate change. And those things ignore national borders. So we have on Earth around about 195 national governments, national geographies, with their own governments, institutions, and administrations within them. And we could see during COVID that they operated in a totally disintegrated way to manage something that ignored national borders. So in COVID, climate, and conflict, those things are dynamically moving across the globe, ignoring national boundaries, but we can only manage them from 195 things within national boundaries. So the things that actually do ignore national boundaries and operate really efficiently and effectively is commerce and its brands. Now, as a citizen of the world, I have no democratic lever to pull to decide who manages COVID for me, who manages climate for me, and who manages conflict for me. All I have to do is rely on these ancient institutions like the WTO and the UN that were last designed, first designed in, and not designed since in 1948, when the world was very different. They were just designed by a load of white guys in Northern Europe and a colonial world, which has now completely changed. So they do their best, those institutions, but they need to be redesigned for purpose. So I've got no democratic lever to pull. It's like I live in a rotten borough in the 18th century. I've got no one in parliament to manage what the quality of my life. So the only way I can express what I want is how I spend my money, and how I spend my money on the products that represent the future I want to live in, and the brands that represent the future I want to see. So when you see that and you understand, actually, I may not have democratic power, but I have commercial power, and I'm one of 8 billion consumers on Earth. And if we start to spend our money in an organized way, then you can see how brands could become a new democracy. And you can see how they can become important in that they will shape the space for governments to move towards. So, for example, if you take the civil rights movement in America, yes, Lyndon Baines Johnson did enact the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Act. But he got there because culture created space for him to move into. He got there because Bob Dylan wrote Blowing in the Wind. And that pissed off Sam Cooke, who wrote A Change Is Going to Come, and that helped galvanize and accelerate and catalyze the civil rights movement, from which you then got civil rights policy and politics, and then governments followed that. And so our role in culture and our role as designers is to create the space for them to move into and recognize where it's going. They'll follow.
Right, but how can brands do that? Is that what your regenerative brand design concept is all about?
Yeah, it's basically, so when you look at growth, to redesign a brand, you have to redesign growth. For growth to be replenishing and not damaging to life on Earth, but for growth to still give us purposeful, meaningful economic lives where our children go to good schools, we go on great holidays, we live a life, it has to be profitable. So it has to have the profit motive in there. But there's bad growth. And bad growth exists above the ecological threshold for sustainable life. And we're obsessed with it. So last year, half the world's population went to a democratic expression, a democratic election. And the politicians in those elections promised them policy promises, whether it was better public services, more defense, better healthcare, whatever it is, they all promise policy. And then when they're asked the question, how will you pay for this policy? They say, we'll pay for it through economic growth, because that enables them to make their economic promises, that makes their policy promises, and pay for it without increasing direct taxes. But they can increase it through tax growth, through revenue growth, through economic growth. But they don't care where their growth comes from. There's no conversation about what's good growth or bad growth. Similarly, all our personal standing is measured by growth, whether we how many holidays we've been on this year, how many bedrooms our house has got, how many houses have we got, how many cars we have, how many kids at private school. It's all measured through metrics of growth, as it is in commerce. The success of a company is measured by its revenue growth, its profit growth, its market share growth. And so we're kind of fixated. It's addictive politically, it's compulsive economically, but it can be destructive. Too much growth, as we're seeing with the ice caps, with the fires. The world is on fire right now, and we can see it. And so it's too much growth is regressive. It's deconstructive. And so where can growth go so that it replenishes the power planet and it's positive? Well, it has to sit above the threshold for economic life, but it has to sit below the threshold for unsustainable ecological life on Earth. So growth has to sit in the middle there. So how do we then redesign brands so that they can grow there? And there is two examples which have helped inform the book. One is a growing realization that as we move our economic influence from generation X to Y to Z, then the way we consume is shifting from being defined by what we own. My generation, let me buy stuff that shows you how rich I am. I'll buy the Range Rover, I'll drive it. It'll prove to you I'm a great hunter. Your children won't go hungry. Procreate with me. Basic Darwinism, right the way through to Gen Z, where they're less defined by what they own and accumulating things, more defined by accumulating knowledge and experiences. They want to be defined by what they do and what they know rather than what they own. So if that's the general macro shift of consumption, then that means there's an opportunity for brands to not make things, but to make experiences, to make knowledge, to make intelligence and sell that. So that then doesn't end up in landfill. So there's an opportunity there. One of the brands that we worked with last year was a brand in Chamonix, an ice axe company, doing about 100 million of turnover. Brilliant brand, 150 years of alpinism. I'm obsessed with mountaineering and the mountains, but for me to access my love for that brand, it has to manifest in my desire for an ice axe. I live in central London. I don't need an ice axe. So it's a really narrow target. So what we did was say to that brand, look, we need to open up pathways to growth beyond the provision of products. And what we did is we folded a $1 billion regenerative brand into it. So making products that are manufactured regeneratively and sourced regeneratively. So doing 1.1 billion. And then we're selling it through a network of Decathlon stores, meaning it can get to 3.5 billion. So making a virtue of scale because it's going to be regenerative. And do it making less products. So making it the biggest outdoor brand in the world, bigger than the North Face, but making less products, because what we designed were pathways to growth that involved rental, involved well-being for the mountain, involved fitness for the mountain, involved insurance for the mountain, education for the mountain, guiding for the mountain, training for the mountain, nutrition. All these things are pathways to economic growth that don't require the making of a thing. So it's just working through, okay, if people are going to be more consumed by what they do than what they own, then how can we redesign brands to take their meaning system and deploy it for the provision of memories and experiences, intelligence? And I got there in a conversation with a friend of mine who used to run Columbia Music 20 years ago. So his economic model in New York was, right, I've got to sell CDs, so I've got to sell things. I need to get on the phone to Beyonce and tell her to write an album for Destiny's Child. Beyonce writes the album. I then get on the phone to the manager of Destiny's Child and say, go on tour because I need to promote the album. So the product was the CD, the byproduct was the tour. Napstar came out, started streaming his things, and then iTunes scaled it. All of a sudden, his things disappeared, and he had to change his economic model from being focused on the things, his product, to the byproduct, which was the experiences. People are still spending money to watch the tour and they're watching an experience, and they're banking the memory. So it proves to me, actually, and when you look at the economics of that now, that's where the music industry is making all their money on tours and in live music. So it showed me that you could take a brand meaning system and pivot like we did with the ice axe company in the mountains. So that's what we're doing now. We've built 21 protocols, seven product design protocols, seven brand design protocols, and seven corporate design protocols to start to design both companies and brands from within. And then those protocols are going to become an educational platform at Central Saint Martins so that we can educate the future CEOs of the future. So they become kind of sleeper cells and go and work in the biggest brands in the world and change them all from within. And that's our sort of plan for world domination or change.
Oh, hopefully. But yeah, I think what the most interesting point you're making here, Bob, is that brands can actually grow and be profitable while making less products, don't they?
Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. And the music industry has proven it.
Definitely. Great. And then you mentioned consumers and different generations and how they change their relationship with brands and so on. We know that Generation Z, they're becoming more and more influential now. But to be honest, Bob, Gen Z is they don't have the same kind of resources that other generations have. So can they be responsible for making better brand decisions when they might not be able to afford them?
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, what do we know about Gen Z? We know there are shitloads of them. They're going to be the largest economic group by 2040. There are more people living in England or Britain today. They were born this century than there are people living in England born in the last century. So we know there are loads of them. We know they're frustrated. We know they don't trust brands. And we know they want better futures. Those are the four sort of main truths of it. What would happen is instead of doing vacuous advertising, brands started to consider, how can we make Gen Z have better futures? How can we take what we do, our meaning system, and deploy it from storytelling to story doing? How could we build better futures for those consumers by giving them more education, by giving them more intelligence, by giving them more knowledge? If you're a consumer, you're going to remember who gave you your first job, right? That's going to make you connected to that brand forever. So we're looking at ways of working with companies like Goodwill, where we can say to a company, for the same price of an ad, why can't we change a whole cohort, a whole generation's future, and do the storytelling around that, as opposed to just do storytelling around vacuous lifestyle stuff? So it's not just Generation Z's responsibility, it's my generation's responsibility as well, to help try and redesign the way brands accrue meaning and activate into their consumer base. And we all have a responsibility to do it. It will end up being not one generation's responsibility. It will be 8 billion of us on Earth, all with mobile phones, all connected like never before. And it will be 8 billion acts of consumerism that will help create the space and the shifts that are necessary to redesign global prosperity.
Absolutely. And but what I think is very interesting here is that we know that Gen Z, they want a better future, and they're more cautious of their purchasing decisions and how they're impacting the planet. But is that also the case for older generations? Do you think they're that aware of how their purchases affect our environment? Or is that something we need to educate them on?
Both, yeah. I mean, the way to do this is we have to, when we're looking to redesign things, we have to educate. We have to redesign our CEOs. And we have to redesign the way we see ourselves, the way we define our status. I'm doing a lot of work at the moment in fashion. And fashion used to be at the head of the game. It used to be ahead of consumers, as did brands. And what happened during COVID is brands and companies were quite rightly just focused on survival. And so they were focused on, 63 different law changes on how to deploy furlough and how to just stay alive. But at the same time, it meant they became a bit myopic. And what they didn't see is that the value systems of consumers changed as they were forced to rethink the way they live their lives. They were forced to rethink the rules that they live by, the way they spend their time, the purpose of their life. And so consumers have shifted and accelerated at a pace that brands haven't kept up in. And it's really obvious when you see it in fashion. So fashion is predicated on planned obsolescence. It needs things to go out of fashion so new fashions can come in. Well, that simply can't work for the planet. We have to see planned obsolescence in both tech and in fashion as something that's morally repugnant because the planet can't afford it. So we then have to start to look at fashion and say, how can we redesign fashion in such a way that it can wean itself off planned obsolescence and be not so obsessed with the new? How can we redesign fashion so that it is circular? So it used to be a jacket used to be a plastic bottle, but it's going to become a carrot or whatever it might be. And so we're working with lots of different companies to try and change that within. So if we can change it in fashion, if fashion can wean itself off planned obsolescence and find new economic models for growth, then that can change the whole of design. And so that's where we're working with them. And the first part of it is becoming, is fashion coming to the realization that we don't love perfection. This is where consumers are ahead. Consumers don't love perfection. When they watch tennis and they see Djokovic win his 23rd Grand Slam or whatever, they look at him and they respect him, but they don't love him. They respect him because he's a metronome of perfection. When they see McEnroe come on court, who's only won a handful of Grand Slams, they love him because they recognize in his imperfections, they see themselves, they see his vulnerabilities, they see his fragilities, and they love him for it. And so when you take that to a product and you take that, so say to the Eastern concept of wabi-sabi, where you get a piece of ceramic that's broken, so it's imperfect, and then it's remade with gold inlay, and it looks beautiful, and it's more beautiful because of its breakages, because of its imperfections, then you can start to see how that can change design. When we look at how fashion operates in our personal meaning system, and you see all these adverts which have been airbrushed, you know, beyond recognition, and you see these parodies of perfection, you realize that they're just unattainable. What we've got to do is start to accept in people perfections. We've got to see that scars are great, that lines are great. They mean wisdom, they mean experience. And we've got to place value on wisdom and experience and growing old as opposed to trying to permanently stay young. And we have to translate that into our products so that when we're seeing someone in a really old pair of jeans with character or a hole in their jumper, that's not because they're skint or have got no money. It's because that's a considered choice that represents their authentic self and they want to portray of themselves a level of authenticity and consideration that I don't need to keep buying stuff. And so, but there'll always be the need for new, but then we have to figure out how we deliver the new in a replenishing way. So we deliver the new and we design it with long aesthetic lifespans, long durable lifespans, so that when it lasts a long time, you still want to wear it. So we design elegant decay into it. We design a multi-use afterlife. And when we manufacture it regeneratively, understanding that that's a nested system that will have wider impact, the same when we source it. And if we can aggregate all these things together, we can change fashion. And if we can change something like fashion, we can change everything else. So that's how we're going to go about doing it. But just emphasis, it's not, it has to make a profit. And we have to recognize there's an inherent truth there. We also have to recognize there's a truth that Generation Z maybe in the queue, the first in the queue to protest for this, but they're also the first in the queue for an iPhone. So they want beautiful and good things as well. So we've got to manage and reconcile those things. This is not a false alternative situation, but we'll get there.
Absolutely. Okay, and now for any, well, business owners who might be listening to us today, what are the first steps that they should take to start on a journey of a more sustainable future for their brands?
Well, the first step is to realize that this isn't an either-or situation. The first step is none of this works unless you make a profit. Now, one of the issues that we've got with CEOs today is McKinsey last year published that in the fashion sector, CEOs have let sustainability drop off the top five most important priorities because they don't connect it to the things they're measured on, which is revenue growth and profit growth. But actually, we can connect it to shareholder value. We've analyzed the 50 most valuable companies in the world. We've looked at their brand roles, and three out of the top six are about reimagining the world, changing the world, and redesigning the world, which creates you a much higher multiple, which gets you much higher shareholder value. So we can connect that and show and prove to CEOs, actually, you do need to do this. But you only are able to do it if you can make a profit. So you have to start with the conventions, the basics, which is designing your brand in such a way that the positioning is going to generate turnover, that the personality is going to generate profit, and that the purpose will generate purpose and will generate value. And then what you have to do is look at what's inside your brand that can be monetized in terms of the latent intelligence, knowledge, and experiences that your brand can create, and then monetize that so you can grow beyond zero without making products. But then look at the way you design and provide the products that you need to create to sustain yourselves and do that in a regenerative way. I recently listened to a lecture by Jacquemus, the designer, and I was totally seduced by him and his story of living in an agricultural Provence, walking through lavender fields, being inspired. And I thought, yeah, I want to connect with that. I'd love to get into that brand. However, I'm a comprehensively educated school kid from the industrial north in Halifax, and I live in London. And the idea of me connecting to that brand is pretty difficult when the only way I can really do it is through the acquisition of a pink handbag. It's not going to happen for me. So, how do I connect to Jacquemus without having to buy a pink handbag? I can't. But what he can't see, his blind spot, is I'm really attracted to him and his brand. So how can I get that? I'd love to walk through a lavender field and hear the experience. I'd pay for that. So it's about opening your lens through which you interpret what your brand can do over and above the simple provision of a product. And today we can do that because we can now treat digital and physical as one, and we're all connected by 8 billion phones. So there's no reason why we can't do it. It's just a shift of perspective.
Absolutely, I really like that. But I think here the big question, Bob, is do you actually believe we can solve the problem for the sake of our future and for the future of the coming generations?
Yes. I believe that it falls to us to make good choices now. It falls to us to make the space for policy to move into. And it falls to us to see what we're doing like the cathedral builders of generations ago. When people built cathedrals in the ancient cities of Europe, they knew they would never see them finished. They knew they were doing it for the benefit of generations that were to come. So we've got to deploy a little bit of cathedral thinking. And what we're actually doing is we're creating windows. We haven't solved sustainable life on Earth now. There's 7 to 8 billion of us on Earth right now. Scientists suggest by the end of the century, there'll be 12 billion of us on Earth. So we haven't solved it now. The likelihood of us solving the puzzle in our lifetime is very slim. Understanding the puzzle is a start. And what we've got to do is make the choices today as brand designers. And as brand designers, we're responsible for the design of global production and global consumption. It's a big responsibility. If we can start to make good choices today, we can extend the window of time so that someone or some people who aren't born yet will be the ones that solve sustainable life on Earth. We're not here to create the solution for that, but I think we are here to make good choices that extends the horizon as far as possible so that they have as much time as necessary to be able to solve it with the technologies that are then are available.
Yeah, I think that's a great message. And then I have just one final question to you. So, if there's just one thing you wish people to take from your book, what would that be?
To start to see themselves and the value in themselves, not by what they own, but by what they do and by what they know.
Oh, I think that's a great note to finish on. So, thank you very much, Bob, for your time today. I found this conversation very interesting and fascinating. And of course, I encourage our listeners to grab a copy of The Brand New Future and read more about your brand design concept.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.